Okay, we are just concluding our third month now in our study, the chronological study Bible, which is the State Bible in the New King James Version, one of the more popular contemporary and very accurate translations. Really like the New King James Version. And what this book, though, has done is to rearrange the entire Bible story and history into what would read more like a novel or a chronological order. Although, as you've been learning, the first five books that we have in our Bibles, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, all written by Moses, have been collected into chronological order. So we keep saying chronological study Bible every week, you know, and rearranging, but so far there hasn't been any rearranging. When you read Genesis, you are looking at about 2,400 years of history. And Moses doesn't appear in it at all. But once you get to the following four books, those together either are about Moses and his times, or with Genesis being written by Moses, these five books encompass Moses' story occupies one-seventh of all the pages that you have in your Bible. He's not just a central character, you know, he is just a predominant and dominating character in world history and in Bible history. And you can see in the second line I put on the chart there, if you translate that into how big your New Testament is, then the space that is occupied by the New Testament, we could take and see two-thirds of it is that amount of space that's devoted to Moses. Of course, you'll find him in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. So the books that we're studying right now are profoundly important. They are giving us the beginnings of all of God's interactions with his people. Now, to do a quick review, because we're getting ready to start Numbers tonight, the first book, of course, is Genesis. That means that it is the book of beginnings. While this book is written by Moses, he's not an eyewitness of these events. They all predate him by a long time, 2,400 years of history, as I've said. So he's not an eyewitness. But God has inspired him to write down many things which only God could know about the creation, as well as this huge span of 24 centuries worth of history. So Genesis is the book of beginnings. That leads us then to the book of Exodus, which actually skips about 300 years from the death and the entombment of Joseph at the end of Genesis in chapter 50. About 300 years will pass before Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1. But Moses now is the eyewitness. It is the story of Moses and his freeing these people from the Egyptian captivity. So one of these days I'm going to have to preach that lesson, Trials, Tragedy, and Triumph. I didn't really intend to have all those T's going. Just kind of fell out when I got to working with it. But that is what the story of Moses' life is all about. Last Sunday night, hoping to tie this material together and expand on it a little bit, since we have to go so rapidly on Wednesday, covering some 12 chapters here tonight. You know, we are also trying to tie the book of James together, which tells us how to deal with trials for our own sake today as Christians. And Moses is the perfect example. His life was a misery, brethren, most of the time. He suffered horribly as a servant of God. The privilege of being this great leader and being so renowned and having a seventh part of the Bible, you know, devoted to his life story and the examples that he sets, he really paid a price for that. And particularly in the book of Numbers, we'll be seeing that. But, of course, in the face of all those trials and sometimes terrible tragedy and the deaths of tens and even hundreds of thousands of people on his watch and during his lifetime, he himself triumphs over all of this, fulfills God's will, does rescue these people and their descendants to enter into that promised land. So they leave the Egyptian captivity. Exodus covers about 1 year. It covers the escape, of course, of the Jews, and then the first year that they're in the wilderness. That brings us to the book we had in the last two lessons, the third book of Moses, which is the book of Leviticus. Who's it named after? Levi. What was the tribe of Levi? All of his descendants would be the people that were the priests, the men that were of a certain age and who did not have any blemishes in their bodies and, you know, met all the requirements. And this book is particularly devoted to them. It is about their activities. It is about consecrating them. It's about what they wear and what they do. It is the book that is uniquely designed to teach those men how to fulfill their functions as intermediaries between God and men, and the ones, of course, that are offering all the sacrifices in the tabernacle during the wilderness wanderings. But that book, as you see, if you read in the narrated Bible, the transition at the start of the book of Leviticus 2 weeks ago, that whole book was written and covers events of only about 6 weeks. So all of these laws that God is revealing to Moses, he is writing down, he's writing the book in the course of about 6 weeks. These 6 weeks will see the completion of the tabernacle, which we've studied in quite some detail. So I'm not going to show you, you know, all the cutaway versions and everything. We talked about it, all of how that was constructed. But it will be in the center of this camp with a cloud of what by day? A pillar of what by day? Cloud. I'm never going to get this right. I said smoke a couple of weeks ago. So it's a pillar of cloud by day, and then what is it at night?
Fire.
Okay, a pillar of fire. You will have learned in the reading, numbers is about numbers. You know, we have all the two of these census that take place, but actually they represent a number of different countings of the people that are involved here. We are looking at, by some estimates, perhaps as many as 3 million people who are on the move. Is that what we have in Europe right now? We have a lot of people on the move, but it's nothing like that. Nothing like that. It's not the tenth part of that. And so this is a scale that is far beyond all that we're seeing in our modern news right now. And through it all, day or night, all you have to do is look up, and what do you know? God is in the presence of these people. God is the leader of these people. God makes all of the rules, and God has chosen these people for his own purposes, and God is now training them to worship him and to serve him in an extremely detailed and precise manner. What did we learn 2 weeks ago in Leviticus chapter 10? If any one of these people decided that they wanted to change even the tiniest part of this law, then what happened to Nadab and Abihu? Fire comes down from heaven, they are immediately killed, and what is their daddy told about this? You may not even weep for them, because God says, I will be, what? Honored. They had dishonored God, because they had simply chosen to neglect what God had said they should do and substituted something else. They become an object lesson. Now, ever since that time, you do things God's way, or whether immediately or later, you'll be paying for that. So now we come to the book of Numbers. Now, that's not actually, you know, a manuscript from Numbers itself, but it is, you know, Hebrew and an ancient manuscript, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that you have right there. Moses is writing something, you know, like that, on an animal skin or on papyrus or something. We don't have the originals. Those materials can't survive the ravages of time. But now we come this week to the first 12 chapters of this fourth book that Moses has written. This book is, of course, an eyewitness account, again, as will be Deuteronomy, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. All have to do with face-to-face contact, that is, Moses meeting with God and hearing in his ears the very voice of God as he is also then carrying that message to these people. There is, in this book, two times that God orders a census. Though, as I say, there's actually quite a few different countings that take place. And then we have the wilderness wanderings. The book is going to cover, in a very brief manner, 39 years of wilderness wanderings. And so, Exodus and Leviticus all take place in that first year they're in the wilderness. Numbers picks up from that point and covers all the rest, down to the time that they'll be entering
into that promised land or just before it. Then, as well, as you saw again on Wednesday night, so I didn't get to all of them, in the book of Numbers, there are 10 times that the people rebel against God directly, against Moses, against Aaron, the first high priest. We have all these troubles that take place. And so in particularly this book, Moses does not spend so much time on the law as he did in Exodus and Leviticus. There's more of the action of the wilderness wanderings that takes place there. And so much of these activities are embarrassing to the Jews. They are shameful to these people. They are so forgetful. They are so selfish. They are so whiny from the beginning to the end of all of this. And they well deserve then the punishments that fall upon them. Theirs is the great privilege to be chosen to be God's special people with a much closer relationship to Him than anybody else on the planet at the time. He is rescuing them from slavery. He is taking them into a promised and wonderful land. He has promised them that they'll never be defeated by any enemy. They'll never be hungry. They'll never be diseased. If only what? If only they'll be obedient to Him. But here's Nadab and Abihu, first priests, already negligent and paying with their lives, and the people are going to follow that example as often as they do the other. Now, chapter 1. So if you have your Bibles here, a chronological study Bible tonight, now please open to page 147. If you still don't have a copy, raise your hand, I'll get you one. But if you insist on using your regular Bible, that's fine too. We'll be in Numbers chapter 1. And we'll just start with the very first verse there at the top of 147. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. So how exactly long have they been free from Egypt? How long has it been since the Passover where they put the blood on the doorpost and the lintel and left? It's been 13 months. This is second year, start of the second month. They've been exactly 13 months so far out there in that wilderness. And what we're going to have now, of course, is the reason that the book has been named as it has, the numbering in this chapter of Israel's warriors by tribe. 12 tribes are named. There's actually 13 tribes. Why? Bill and I were talking about this a minute ago. Joseph had two sons, each of which are going to be counted as a separate tribe, where the others don't have this privilege. Joseph's two sons did. But then, the Levites are often going to be exempted from various things because they are the chosen tribe to be the priests of God. They're not being numbered in this chapter, for instance, but you still have 12 tribes then that are being numbered. Skip on down to verse 17, a little past the middle of the page in that left-hand column. Moses and Aaron took these men who had been mentioned by name. They assembled all the congregation together on the first day of the second month. They recited their ancestry by families, by their fathers' houses, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and above, each one individually, as the Lord commanded Moses, so he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. Now, if you're reading Leviticus 1, verses 17, 18, and 19, you'll find out that there's something other than and more than just a bunch of people running around with a pencil and paper and counting heads. What are the people also doing during this counting? They are verbally reciting this genealogy. Now that's a curious thing, and God does not tell us directly, but who's got an idea tonight? Why is this exercise going to take place? Every tribe recites its lineage and gets numbered in the end of the 13th month as they've just completed the tabernacle, just ordained all of their priests, offer their first sacrifices. They are good to go now. What is the census all about, do you suppose? Carol?
Being able to trace the lineage of Christ eventually.
That's exactly it. These are the chosen people. And there are prophecies, we'll be seeing a lot of them as we study this Old Testament, of the coming of one who will be the Savior, not just of the Jews, but of the entire world. And he must come from those people and a particular tribe and a particular family. He has to be an Israelite from the tribe of Judah and the family of David. Okay? Now, we also have this numbering, and the numbers are huge. So, why that, do you suppose? Bill? We're identifying who these people are. We are setting these people in place and probably giving the nation a little bit of confidence too, aren't we? That's a pretty sizable army, to say the least. Now, what I'm imagining is happening here, I don't think we have a specific statement, but what it looks like to me is that God is saying to these people, I want you to think about how unique you are. I want you to think about how special you are. I want you to know who you are. We want that genealogy, which is so important to the coming of the Messiah, that it's one of the identifying traits and prophecy for him, to be known by you, to be recited by you. We want you to identify yourself as unique from all the rest of the world as God's chosen people. And perhaps in the numbering also to recognize, and you're no bunch of pushovers. You're a very sizable nation, up to 3 million people. Estimates run from 1 to 3 million people, and an enormous army. So, what happens in chapter 2? We get the numbering and the organizing of that army. So chapter 1 sets out to number all of these people. Chapter 2 is a subset, and we're going to have not just a numbering, but an organizational system that takes place too. The total number of soldiers over the age of 20. So they didn't draft you at 18 like we do. You've got to stay home for a few more years. And so 603,550 is a very serious army. These are the ones who will be prepared and trained for war with God's divine providence behind them. They can't lose as long as they're faithful. Here's one of just many charts that tell us how God now is organizing that army. There is a perimeter of soldiers. On the eastern side, three tribes are positioned with their soldiers. And then on each of the remaining sides as well, you have three tribes. And on this particular chart, they put this triangle shape right here to show that in each set of three tribes, one tribe and its head slash leader is designated as what you might call the general for those three tribes. So, these three tribes on the east side, which is the front side of the tabernacle, the side that you would enter the tabernacle if you were a priest, these men have a leader in Judah, as does each of the others. Now, you have 3 million people, you have 603,000 soldiers, you got the tabernacle and the encampment there in the center. If somebody is foolish enough to try to attack, whatever direction they come at you, what are they going to meet? They're going to meet a very sizable force of men who cannot fail if they'll be faithful to their God. So this organization is going to be continuing, actually, for quite some time, all the way down into David. We're going to see various organizational schemes that either God himself will dictate or the various leaders will be allowed by God to arrange themselves. But what you have is one fit fighting machine that is there to protect these people. So, here's one artist's conception of what just, close in, this encampment might have looked like. We had several weeks when we were looking at the courtyard and the heavy fabric that separated it, you know, so that we could look into that, the various articles of the tabernacle service, the tabernacle itself, and then you'll also be collecting not only numbers but elsewhere. Here on the east side, which is the entrance to the tabernacle, Aaron and his sons, what tribe were they from? Levi. They were stationed right there at the entrance. And next to them was Moses and his family. Okay? And then we have three other families of Levites that you were reading about and that were being numbered. And they are being positioned, Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, on the remaining sides of the tabernacle. So at the center is God at the tabernacle, pillar above him, night and day. A courtyard that only the priests can enter into. Priests positioned immediately closest to that tabernacle. And then, three tribes on either side, in this case the east side, Judah, is the leader, so that they have a defensive position as well. Then, lastly in chapter 2, the marching orders are given. Who starts out first? Every time the pillar moves, we have to move, pack everything up, we're leaving. And then, 12 tribes, one after the other, what happens? God dictates which one moves first. Judah's going to be in the front. And then, as we stretch out, perhaps 1 to 3 million people on the march, what is in the center of this phalanx and column of people that's coming through the wilderness? What was in the middle? The tabernacle being carried by its various families of priests, each of whom have been assigned the various parts of that tabernacle when it's all folded up and collected, that they themselves, you know, are detailed to carry. So, in chapter 3, well, hold on a second. Let me go back for just a second. Make sure. It's okay. We'll just go on into chapter 3 then. So in chapter 3, while they were not permitted to be numbered with everybody else, later, God does want the Levites to be numbered as well. Precisely, if you went through, as I did, and added up the numbers of the three families as they're given in chapter 3, the number comes to 22,300 Levites. Do the Levites ever pick up a sword or a bow and arrow? No. Are they warriors? No. What are they? They're priests. And because they're dedicated to God, that is their only function. And what we learn is that 1 month and older, so not 20 years and older, Levites are being numbered from infancy, from only 30 days old. They had 22,300 Levites. But at the end of chapter 3, in verse 39, please turn over to page 150, and after all this lengthy numbering that takes place there, you get a summary in verse 39 of Numbers 3. All who were numbered of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the commandment of the Lord by their families, all the males from a month old and above, were what? 22,000. Is that correct? Loaded question. Is it the same number that we were given earlier? No. When you add up the families, there's 300 more. Then he says, the total is, and it's 300 less. What is the significance of that? What is the meaning of that? Is it anything more than that God can round off numbers the same way we do? See? It was a precise number. They knew exactly what it was. But people die. People are born. The number's flexible. It's going to be changing all the time. And please remember this. Because repeatedly, you're going to find people attacking the Bible and saying, well, this stupid writer, you know, wasn't Moses to begin with. They'll deny that just to start. And then they'll say, you know, these people can't even agree among themselves. And even in one chapter, they can't even add, you know. And so if you add it up, it's 22,300. They say it's 2,200. So it's just mathematically incorrect. And therefore, your whole Bible should be thrown away. Well, really, ask me how old I am. we were going to be here a long time. I'm 63. Ask me what month I was born in. February. So am I 63? No, no, I'm actually 63, and March, April, May, June, July, August, September, and 7 months. Does that change anything? No. And I don't have to change the count every day to give you a month, a week, you know, a day, and God doesn't either. So what you see here is if you set out to number, don't you suppose they got an accurate number? That's their whole purpose. God on high has asked them to do it. Nadab and Abihu were just killed a couple of weeks ago. You know, they get it. And then the number is recorded two different ways, and it's rounded off in one of them. That tells you your Bible will use round numbers sometimes. It's not an error. It's done the same way that you and I round numbers up to this day for convenience, for brevity. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and turn the screen off now.
From this point, we're not going to have any more slides. So we're just going to focus on the book itself.
We've got about half an hour to go here. Please don't hesitate to raise your hand if you have any kind of question whatsoever, unless you're Jimmy Latham.
She warned me she had a question coming tonight and wanted to. Everybody's loving it. Bob, what do you got?
You make the statement that the Levites were all priests, but that's not exactly correct, is it?
No, no, you're right, and thank you for catching that. I must have misspoken. Only Levites can be priests. Are all Levites priests? No. So, first, you know, you had to be physically perfect, unblemished. You had to be of a certain age. You couldn't be defiled by any particular, you know, coming in contact with a dead body or something like that. So that's absolutely right, Bob, and I just misspoke. Not all Levites are priests, but only priests. Only Levites are priests. Let's get it right. Only Levites are priests. Okay, I have another hand up. Okay, let's go on in chapter 4 then. We have now the duties that are being assigned. And I'm not going to spend much time on this at all. Each of these various tribal and family groupings, that especially of the Levites, that have been numbered, have been selected and chosen for particular responsibilities, both in the function of the sacrificial system as well as in the transport of the tabernacle and all its various implements. So we'll just take one of them. Let's take Gershon. That would be on page 151. It would be in Numbers chapter 4, right-hand column. And we're going to be looking at verse 21 right there under duties of the sons of Gershon on the right side up toward the top. Page 151. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, also take a census of the sons of Gershon by their father's house, by their families, from 30 years old and above, even to 50 years old, you shall number them. All who enter to perform the service, to do the work in the tabernacle of meeting. So Gershon had certain responsibilities, but the age limits for Levitical tabernacle-related service is what? How many years do you get to serve?
20.
From age 30 to age 50. Can't do it before that. Can't do it after that. And as we've seen in previous lessons, not all things being equal, by the time you hit 50, how easy is it to hold up in that sacrificial system? You're going to have guys keeling over with heart attacks. It is extremely, you know, energetic form of worship. They have to handle meat, very heavy, many of the utensils and other things that are involved right there, the high heat all the time next to that altar. It's just grueling work that they're involved in. So nobody before they're 30, nobody after they're 50. That's the way this is going to work. And, of course, Merari and Kohath at the first are also mentioned in this chapter. Each of them are numbered. There are several thousand in each group. We're finding out as you look at these numbers that they are very large. Some of you have been asking me, and I really want to thank you for the feedback I'm getting on this class, which is
universally positive and very energetic. I know you're enjoying this, and I really appreciate it. You know, it helps me too. And several times now, I've had people after class up till 9 o'clock, you know, we stand around talking about these various things. And so we're getting very involved and very interested in all of this. But what we're finding out as we look at all these numbers now is that it's kind of hard sometimes to wrap your mind around it. 603,550 fighting men. That's a lot. Anybody tell me what the population of Eugene or Springfield is? You know?
Less than 300,000.
Less than half what they had for fighting men. You put both cities together. We're talking about all of Eugene and Springfield and two, three, four times more that's going to move tomorrow. Because the pillar moves, there will not be anybody in the valley. We're going to be gone by nightfall. Every last living one of us, and many more. Now, if we all headed north, what would Portland be thinking? We're looking at a human tsunami here. And it would engulf and overwhelm and possibly destroy the whole town. The entire infrastructure, you know, would fall apart. And what in the world are you coming for? So we're seeing huge numbers and recognizing then that it is impossible for these people to live in the wilderness. What will it require every day to keep them alive? We're going to get the manna. We're going to get the water. We're going to have God caring for these people. And so, time and again, there'll be stories that involve that, you know, as well. So, now, chapter 4, we have, you know, all these duties that are delineated, and then we come to chapter 5. Now, with chapter 5, all of our numbering, temporarily, is over. We'll do it again toward the end of the book. But now, we come into a section where laws are being revealed, continuing to be revealed. The first of chapter 5 there, as you can see from the title on page 152, left column down at the bottom, ceremonial unclean persons are isolated and they have various means to handle those sorts of problems. But then, at verse 11 and through to the end of the chapter, what do we have? We have this most singular story. What should a man do if he suspects his wife of adultery, but he did not come home unexpectedly and catch her, what they call it, in flagrante? See, he didn't actually see it. He's just worried about it. He thinks it might be so. He may be right. He may be wrong. But God gave them a procedure by which that husband could satisfy his fears. He could find out by a divine process whether or not she was guilty, would live or die, you know, as a result. And it is, brethren, unlike anything else in Scripture. And so it causes us, you know, at least to stop and to say, well, what was that all about? You know, it's just so unusual. So Jimmy, you warned me, you know, specifically, did you have a particular aspect of this you want to ask about? What was your question?
I wondered what the bitter word was, but after I thought about it all the way through, if she was innocent, she didn't have to take the bitter water, and she had to make the priest understand whether she was guilty or not. I'm sure God had a hand in that. And if she were guilty, she had to drink the bitter water, and it caused the rotting of the hips, which I don't understand, or the swollen belly, but it was a curse. And those were the signs of the curse, and the whole congregation would see it, and she would be a shameful woman and not accept it.
See, that's right. Adultery is no small matter. Adultery may be the run-of-the-mill everyday thing that everybody expects in America, but it's absolutely unacceptable. We as a society have changed all the rules now, you know, so that's a big deal. Everybody does it. Somehow that, you know, makes it all right. It does not. It's no more acceptable in the eyes of God today than it was back then. But they were living
in a very unique period of time. And during this time, then, this system existed to identify an adulterous woman and to punish her pretty severely. Come back to that in a second. I'll put your question back.
Is there anything that talks about if the man is
adulterous? Okay. This is why I hate teaching these classes. Again, by our society's standards today, your Old Testament is about as sexist as anything could ever get. Which is only to say, men are different than women. And there's nothing, you know, to be said about trying to force them to behave exactly the same way, or to have the same responsibilities or the same authority. Now, in the New Testament, is God entirely, give me a fancy word, egalitarian, so that there is no difference between men and women in the New Testament? Did it change? No, it really didn't. There's still a difference between men and women. Whether it's Old Testament or New Testament, is there any difference in God's sight in the value of a man as regards a woman? No. But there are very different rules and regulations and activities. So the direct answer to both of your questions over here is no. And you would have seen that in the chart I gave you all last week from Leviticus 18. No. It is not always same-same. And there is no similar, here's what you do. You have a recipe here for a particular kind of what we call bitter water. She has to drink it. And if she's innocent, it won't do anything to her. If she's guilty, she's going to suffer horribly. Is there a similar thing for men? No. Now, by the way, what is the penalty for a woman who commits adultery? It's death. What is the penalty for a man who commits adultery? It's also death. Now there are some different laws, you know, have to do with whether or not she's betrothed, whether or not she was married, you know, there's some more particulars involved, but the fact of the matter is there any difference in the penalty? No. There is not a similar means of identifying an adulterous man as over the woman. Does the Bible tell us why? No. So can I answer your question?
No.
You don't want to know if there is. You want to know why there's not. Go ahead, fess up. I know what you're asking. You know there isn't. You just want to know why there isn't. I cannot answer that question. Now, when Nadab and Abihu could not answer the question, why did God want this particular wood to be put in our censers for the incense? They couldn't answer that question. What did that change or mean? Nothing. God said it's going to be this way, and that's the way it's going to be, and that's the test, and I don't know why. And that's when faith enters into the matter. So I can't tell you. I know that's the way God wanted it for reasons that I don't understand. But again, I'm sorry, it sounds like the woman what?
Is his possession.
Is his possession. And to a very real degree and sense, she is. That is correct. And there's nothing wrong with that. Is there a sense in which your children are your possession? Well, it surely is. And when I speak of my wife, that's because of what? She's mine and nobody else's. Period. Okay. Is that a bad thing? Don't ask them. That's a bad thing. And brother, one of the biggest problems we have as Bible students today is taking our culture and our values and trying to impose them back there. And there are two problems with that. One is the law that they're under back there is different than the one we're under today to begin with. So already you've got a disconnect. But number two, brethren, God said it. It's not ours to pass a judgment on it and decide that we think we know a better way to do it.
This is about 101 times out of 100. When we're not doing it God's way, then who's right and who's wrong? We're wrong. And it doesn't have to seem fair or right or good or wise in our eyes. Because when it comes to fair and right and good and wise, who is the only one that can tell us how to define those things? God. We make mistakes. We're human. We're very limited and finite, and we're extremely foolish. And we don't even know our own selves. You know, Jeremiah 6. The heart is exceedingly deceitful. You know, we're very, very poor judges. So, innumerable times, out of culture, we'll say, that's wrong, I don't like it, it's unfair. Are any of those things true? No, because God said do it that way. Okay, of course the hand's going up. We'll give Jimmy the next one again.
We do know what the bitter water was that tells what it was made up of.
Yeah, there's a recipe that's specifically given. Okay, Carol?
If you look at the context, you've got men who are being required to be lawyers. They've got to do training. They've got to do guard duty. They've got to be away from their family. They've got all of these people they don't know around. If he thinks, he's worried, in order to keep the marriage strong, to understand that he's got nothing to worry about if she's done nothing, here is this test.
Yeah.
If you look at it from that common sense thing, not that we're out to catch her because of that, it's because of his mental stress that he thinks something's going on, whether there is or not.
Amen. Satisfy him. Now, just one more thing I want to add, you know, on the possession thing. Brethren, in the Bible, is there slavery?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you own a slave?
Yeah.
Sure you do. Okay. Did God regulate that?
Yeah.
Was it a sin to be a master or a slave?
No.
No. That is not a simple thing in and of itself. God established that relationship. He also said how it's supposed to be operated, and if you do it incorrectly, you get punished whether you're master or slave. Okay? So again, in our culture, we get through a lot in our history, you know, since the 1860s, we're pretty down on slavery. I am, you are, and rightly so. But it's not evil in and of itself. It wasn't evil back then, and our society often just doesn't know how to relate to that. Because we're growing up in a different culture. So it's up to us to be studying that. The possession of one human being by another human being is not inherently evil. It is not sinful in and of itself. Let's go here, Greg.
The bitter water test, it seems to have disappeared by the first century, didn't it?
Along with the rest of the old law, yes. So it is...
Jesus.
You mean, was anybody practicing it before the cross, but in the first century?
Yeah.
The Bible doesn't tell us of any instances, but it also doesn't tell us of any instances of somebody being stoned for breaking the Sabbath or, you know, a host of other things, or being stoned for adultery. You know, and so the fact that I can't read in the New Testament or other parts of the Old Testament examples of every one of these laws does not mean that the Jews weren't practicing them or that they were. It's just that God didn't give us the data. There's the law. They're supposed to. But if just the things about Jesus were written, how much room would we need for the books? See, the whole world couldn't contain the books. In like manner, we get the law. Frequently we get cases where the law is implemented, but not for every law. And then it's just not discussed anymore. So at certain times, people did a good job. They were obeying the laws. At other times, they weren't. They went through cycles of being punished and not, particularly through the time of the judges. You'll see that. But no, I can't tell you because there's not a record there. Bill?
Yeah, the difference between men and women in that society, the best term is frowned upon by God. Man could have more than one wife, but a woman couldn't have more than one husband.
That's correct. And that's one of the numerous...
He has slightly different rules for his behavior.
Differences. Yeah, there's quite a few. If a wife wants to take an oath, can she do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but what's the caveat?
Her husband's okay.
Only if her husband says it's okay. And if he hears it and says, no, you're not going to take that oath, she says she can't. Okay? What if she's not married and she wants to take an oath? She's still living with her dad. Then what? Her dad has to sign off on it. Okay? Now, is that true, you know, for men? No. It's unsettling for us. Okay? But that's our problem. You know, it's not a fault with the Bible, it's not a fault with God. Again.
One more thing. Am I wrong to think that my husband is my possession?
You are not wrong to think that your husband is your possession. Because of the verbiage in 1 Corinthians 7, let each woman have her what? Have her own husband, and likewise, you know, with the men. And so, no, it's not incorrect to think that at all. Okay, let's press on. I've only got about 7 minutes now, and this happens every week, and I understand it. You know, it's particularly tonight, I've been very domineering in previous lessons, and I want you to interact. I want you to be a part of this. Each week, we can't cover everything. This is an overview. We're going to read the whole Bible in 18 months. That's a big task in and of itself. But I do want to just move on through a couple of things, you know, very quickly. So I wish I had more for you on number 5. Fascinating thing, these waters of bitterness. But it's all we know about it. And so really, you can answer your own questions. I can only tell you what that chapter says, and that's all I know about it. You too. Okay, now in chapter 6, we have the Nazarite vow, and very briefly I just want to say, is a Nazarite a Nazarene?
No.
What is a Nazarene? Somebody was born in or lives in Nazareth, okay? A Nazarite is a vow that a man would take to set himself particularly apart for the service of his God. It had a beginning and an end. It was not a lifelong thing. The requirements are given there, and very little else is ever said about it elsewhere in Scripture. God allowed, made provision for people who felt the desire to take especially difficult and uncomfortable steps sometimes to establish their devotion with their God. They wanted to go the extra mile. They could. The Nazarite vow is something like that. Come on over to page 154 now, please. You know, 154, just want to point out, you've all heard this dozens and dozens of times in your life. Hopefully you will have read it this week. But at the bottom of the left-hand column, we'll be in Numbers chapter 6, and starting at verse 22, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." You ever heard that before? Seen it in, what do they call those deals? Is that needlepoint or macrame or what do? You hang it on the wall. I don't know. They're made one. You know, but you see it all the time. You see it in, framed in various stores and all that sort of thing. That's where that blessing comes from. It is God's divine blessing through the priest at that time. And again, it had a purpose. In verse 27, the last line there in that column, "So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." So God will bless the people if his intermediaries, the priest, bless the people with his what? What did the last verse say? What is being put upon them? His name. And we touched on this before. It's just kind of a unique thing. Again, we don't read Hebrew and all of that. But as you look at the word Lord in verse 27, the last sentence there on page 154, just above religion and worship box. "So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." What is the Lord's name? Yahweh often comes out as Jehovah. And in verse 24, the first thing that is said in the prayer, The what bless you and keep you? Verse 25, the what make his face shine upon you? Verse 26, the what lift up his countenance? The Lord. What do you notice all three times about the word Lord and the way it's printed? All four letters are uppercase. They're in capitals. That's a device that is used in many Bibles to alert us to the fact that in the Hebrew, those are the four letters, YHWH, from which we get either Yahweh or Jehovah. If you translate the word, what does it mean? Lord. But it is also designated time and again throughout the prophets, and already has been, as the personal name, Jehovah or Yahweh, of God himself. So, here was a way to put his name upon them. Brother, I believe everything about numbers, all of numbers, is designed to draw the people's attention to the God whose name is blessed above all others and from whom comes every good and perfect gift, which we studied last Sunday in the book of James. Okay? Now, I'm going to skip over chapter 7 altogether. Everybody had some offerings. Go ahead, Bill, very quickly. Yeah, to hit up. Is that right? Did I miss that? Yeah, you're right. In verse 2. I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction. In chapter 6 and verse 2, speak to children of Israel, say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering, said man. But it could be either way. Okay. Then, I did want to just note another place where, you know, the unbeliever decides to romp and stomp and run amok. In chapter 8 on page 157, in the last two paragraphs, so the bottom of the left-hand column on 157 at chapter 8, verse 23, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, this is what pertains to the Levites from how many years old? 25. What was the age before? 30. Well, this is 5 years younger. From 25 years old and above, one may enter to perform service in the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and at the age of 50 years they must cease performing this work and shall work no more. They may minister with their brethren in the tabernacle of meeting to attend to needs, which are not defined for us. And we repeatedly said it required God's divine revelation to tell these people how to define some of these statements. And this one isn't defined for us. I don't know what those needs were. But from 30 to 50, the priests were officiating in the tabernacle itself. From 25 to 30, there were certain needs that were different from the sacrificial system that were introducing these young men, you know, to the priesthood. So it's not a contradiction, it's not a conflict, it's not a failure in the Bible. It's just a fact that there is a five-year period, sort of a training period, with different and lesser duties that also are recognized here. Now in chapter 9, they have their second Passover. They actually perform the Passover, so, you know, that's fine. In chapter 10, please, on 158, turn over to the right-hand column, just underneath the Arts and Literature block, to verse 11 of Numbers 10. Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of testimony. The children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they started out for the first time according to the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Now, what we have learned back in Exodus is that they arrived at Sinai in the third month. And now they are leaving Sinai in what? Last half of the second month of the second year. So, they were only 2 weeks away from spending how much time at Mount Sinai? They spent a year at Mount Sinai. And they got to Mount Sinai 90 days after they came over the Red Sea and parted for them. They get to Sinai. Moses goes up on the mountain. We saw at least five times. He comes back with 10 commandments.
The pagan worshiping the golden calf, he's angry at, and then he organizes these people. He gets control of them. A tabernacle is built, a priesthood is designed and consecrated, and is now fully functional. And in these last 6 weeks of the book of Leviticus, they have consecrated their tabernacle and their priests, and they looked up, and what did the cloud do? It started moving. So what did the Kohathites and the Merarites and the Gershonites do? Packed it up. Who set out first? What tribe? Judah. What's in the middle of maybe 3 million people? The tabernacle. Now, I know the bell rang, but coming to chapter 11 and verse 1 on page 159, I just want you to know I ignore the bell. That's my prerogative. We'll see how long I can last as a preacher if I keep it up. But chapter 11 and verse 1, now, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it. His anger was aroused. The fire of the Lord burned among them, consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. That is, in the book of Numbers, rebellion number 1. We talked about 8 of the 10. There's 10 of them on Sunday night. So I'm trying to help, you know, keep all this material together. The second rebellion is at verse 4. And you will find in the book of Numbers now, to identify yourself, 10 rebellions against Moses and against God. How foolish can you be? And if they can be that foolish in the face of the miracles, in the face of manna every day, you know, in the face of all that, how foolish can we be? Okay. So the next time you're thinking, that's not fair, that's not right, what are you doing? You're grumbling. You're murmuring. What happened to the grumblers and the murmurers in the wilderness? They all died. It's very graphic. You will become corpses. And they did. Everybody over the age of 20. How many men were over the age of 20? 603,550. And out of that number, how many survived to enter the promised land? Joshua and Caleb. 603,548 men and their wives died in the wilderness. Don't sin and don't gripe. Okay? Let's close in prayer. Charles, would you lead us, please?